Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
Welcome back to another episode of Cutting the Distance Podcast. I'm Dirk Durham, and today my guest is a longtime sportsman and sportsman advocate and outdoor writer, lifelong hunter. And if anyone wants to know anything about elk hunting, I feel this is the guy you want to get inside his brain and pick it a little bit. Welcome to the show. I have George Batis here today. Welcome, George.
Thank you, Dirk. It's great to be with you guys.
I've been following George for several years on social media, and I've seen a lot of stuff he's written over the years. And I've always thought he was a pretty neat and fascinating guy. And I thought, you know, who better to get on the podcast and kind of talk about the good old days of elk hunting in Idaho, and in particular, Idaho's Clearwater region. It's kind of a magical place, and I think it's probably arguably one of the most beautiful places to hunt elk there is, as far as picturesque quality, and at one time it was a really neat place to go elk hunting, just because of the whole experience. But I thought I'd bring George on and kind of talk about those good old days and what they looked like back then, and maybe contrast to what it looks like today hunting there. And if any of our listeners, if you guys don't know, not familiar with George, I'm going to take a minute and let George talk about himself. And it's sometimes hard to brag on himself, but if you were to look at his Facebook profile, it's pretty impressive. He served in a lot of different important roles, advocating for sportsmen and among other things through his lifetime of being a hunter and a sportsman. So, George, could you give us a little bit of your background?
I'll give you the executive summary if you want to know more.
Yeah.
Go to Google or Facebook. But, well, I grew up on a small farm in central Washington. We never had elk there. I remember seeing the very first elk way back when I was in probably a sophomore in college in about 1962. It was a big bull lying up in the timber, but we just didn't have elk there. We had a lot of mule deer. And so, elk was a really kind of interesting thing to see on the farm. Well, anyway, after high school, I went on to Washington State University, graduated. I was in the last required class of ROTC, the Return Reserve Officer Training Program. And, of course, after you finish school, you have to go in the Army. So I served in the Army in the late 60s and in their Air Defense Artillery program, or actually branch. And after that, eventually returned to Pullman, Washington, where I started work on my doctorate degree in higher education. And I was there until I retired in 2002. I served in a whole series of positions, director of housing and Dean of Students and ultimately the Vice President of Student Affairs. But but my interest in conservation goes clear back to my just growing up on the farm. I was always interested in birds and, you know, and identifying birds and animals. And I, you know, we had deer and elk, deer on the farm, and we could see elk down in other areas. And so I was always interested in wildlife. And then after I used to say I spent my whole life either in school or in the Army. And it was true until after I got back from back to WSU to work on my doctorate, I started really thinking about hunting and other things I could do. In 1984, the Elk Foundation had their very first convention in Spokane, and I had an interesting, you know, I was hunting elk in Montana at the time up around Superior, and there was a Bugle magazine, and I saw it, and the guy says, where'd you get this? He says, that's the last one. I said, well, do you have any more? He said, no. He said, but you can have that one for $20. So I bought it. Anyway, so I got involved with the Elk Foundation, just as a member, then as a life member and habitat partner, and ultimately was on the board, was elected to the board, served as a board chair during some tumultuous times, kind of with the Elk Foundation, changing CEOs and stuff. Anyway, but parallel to that, I got a call one day from Emmett Burroughs in California. And he asked me, he says, hey, I hear you like to hunt mule deer. I'm putting together a new mule deer foundation. I said, really? He says, would you help us organize it and develop the documents? He said, I've got six other guys coming to Reading. And so I went down there, and I was one of the founders of the Mule Deer Foundation, and then ultimately served as president. But at the same time, in 89, I was invited to become a regular member of the Boone and Crockett Club. And I couldn't do both, so I passed the gavel on with the Mule Deer Foundation and then, of course, at the university, I had a job to do, and I spent time working, you know, with Boone and Crockett. I've been a Boone and Crockett member for 34 years, served in, I guess, all levels of responsibility except president. And that's been a great ride. And that connected to me a lot of different opportunities for, you know, conservation work. The Elk Foundation, when I was on the board, you know, the lands program, I was really involved with that. I was involved with all aspects of it. And I learned all about, you know, I was involved in a lot of those major Elk Foundation land programs as a board member and as an individual. And then after I left Boone and Crockett, actually I left the university. I retired from the university in 2001 and was hired as the executive director of the Boone and Crockett Club, moved to Missoula. I've been here the last 20 years. And that gave me other opportunities to reach out and work with conservation organizations. Elk Foundation on their land projects was one of them. After I retired from Boone and Crockett, I was hired by the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Foundation, you know, and was their executive director and manager of a trust they manage. And in that role, we were able to fund millions of dollars of different public access and fee churches program. So anyway, I flunked retirement four times. And, so that pretty much got it. And all along, when I was at the university, I basically had time to go hunting deer for like a week and elk for a week. And so that's when I discovered the Clearwater. And I can tell that story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. That's quite a impressive list of roles that would consume a lot of time and responsibility, definitely, especially working full time when you're at WSU and you were serving those other roles. That's an incredible that's an incredible achievement, really. That I don't think a lot of people can do that. I know I don't think I would be capable of having that much heaped on my plate on a daily basis. So that's cool.
A lot of the roles I had at WSU were, you know, involved students and student behavior in the residence halls and fraternities and sororities. And, you know, I was on call 24/7. And so I could, you know, typically an elk hunt in Idaho after we figured out, you know, where to go in the Clearwater, I'd have a staff meeting Monday morning and meet my buddy in Lewiston with the horses, and away we'd go, and I'd come back Sunday and be right back at it. 2 weeks later, the deer season opened, and I'd be a week for deer. That was it until maybe Thanksgiving, and then. But you know, I always tell young people to just follow their passion. You know, I don't fish, but I hunt.
Yeah.
And I figured, if you're going to do something well, you got to keep your eye on the football. And for me, it was hunting. It was deer hunting and elk hunting, of course, then brown bears in Alaska, yada, yada, and all those other things I've done. But it was all about hunting, learning your rifles and studying the ballistics and learning to reload, you know, all of that. And so anyway, that's kind of an executive summary.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. So when did you first get into hunting with horses in the backcountry?
Well, the Clearwater is what got me into the horses.
Okay.
What
year was that?
I went in there the first, backpacked in for elk in 1976.
Wow.
But I started going up into the Selway bear hunting in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the guys up in those days, they drove up the highway in the Selway, you know, up to towards the Montana line. And you could see bears any morning, anytime, right from the road. And there are a lot of adventures. I didn't like the river. I didn't want to have to go across the river to get a bear. So I heard about the Clearwater. I went up to Clearwater and up to Kelly Creek and killed a giant bear the first year. And that was in about 73, 74 maybe. But when I was up there in the spring, we'd backpack in near bear hunting. We'd see all these elk. I mean, hundreds of elk everywhere. Wow. We went. Just big. Yeah, I mean, elk were everywhere. I mean, I can tell you, every place I went, there were just elk everywhere. And so I started looking at that, and there was a guy by the name of Del Roby. He used to do outdoor films.
And yeah, I've seen those.
Yeah, and I remember going to one down in Lewiston at the Lewis Clark Sports Club, and they had one of these PVC bugles, and they called in a big 6-point, and it was up in Max Walker's guide area up in Kelly Creek. And the elk come walking in, a guy shot it. And I said, whoa, that's interesting. I've never seen that before. Well, anyway, so I started focusing on the Clearwater. And so my buddy and I, we backpacked way back into the middle of Paradise Meadows hunting, you know, bear hunting. And we had to hike over the snow and all that to get in there. But Dirk, it was one of the most memorable experiences I ever had. Because we bushwhacked because of the snow, and we popped into this big basin, you know, 3 miles by 2 miles.
Yeah.
It was lush. It was green. And there must have been 300 at least cow elk in the meadows with their calves calling back and forth.
Wow.
And we didn't know it at the time, but these big bears were coming in to prey on the elk calves. So we both shot two big bears and skinned them out, and then had to use our map and compass to get back to the highway. but when I saw those elk, I said, whoa, I've got to get in here. It's like 9-10 miles in there.
Yeah.
How am I going to do it? And so I had to put together a group of guys, and guys I knew and guys that were good elk hunters and guys that I trusted. And there was an orthopedic surgeon from up in Bellingham, Washington, and a friend of mine from Seattle that hunted elk together in Oregon. And they'd camp on the Washington-Oregon line. Oregon would open, they'd shoot a spike there, then they'd come back on the Washington side in the Blue Mountains and shoot a spike. So I called Andy and Bob. I said, hey, guys, I said, you want to come to Idaho? We need some horses to get where I want to go. And they said, sure. And so, and then one of my former, well, my secretary's husband was a vet student and ended up ultimately in Pomeroy, Washington. And so he had a horse. And so I bought an old Appaloosa, rat-tail Appaloosa from one of the, the Atleys. And so anyway, actually the fall of 77, we went in with horses. And I didn't know anything about it. Now I say we used to pack like sheep herders because we had deckers and stuff and we'd tie stuff on and it'd fall off and then knots would come. Anyway, it was, those four guys, we hunted that for 12 years.
Wow.
And during that time, we never hunted more than 3 days. It was rifle. We'd pack in on Monday. We'd drive up the trailhead on Monday, pack in Tuesday, set up camp. And the season opened on Wednesday in those days, like the last week of September. And the bulls were just really vocal. I mean, at night you could just hear bulls bugling all around you everywhere. And, the first 2 days we got four nice bulls and we had too much gear. We ended up boning them out because we didn't have enough horses to do everything. And we backpacked what we could and we went out that way. And then we added some horses. I got a couple horses and ended up that we had like 12 horses to go in there, four elk to pack out and four guys in your gear. And that was before lightweight gear,
Sure.
I've got pictures of me in there with my blue jeans and my yellow plastic raincoat soaking wet, those are great. But Dirk, you were in that country, you hunted that country, but
yeah,
and of course I went back and I want to know the history. So I went back, I read everything I could find about the wildfires, Sure. And how the red stem ceanothus was a really important winter food. And I mean, there were so many elk in there in those days and if you've been in there, hiked up over Cook Mountain back in that country, the elk trails were 2 feet wide and a foot deep.
Wow.
Those trails are still there.
Yeah.
I've been in there a couple of years ago and then a couple of years before that. The brush is 10, 12 feet tall. And I knew where the trails were. And I'd be going in there with my horse and pretty soon he'd stumble and he'd fall down in the elk trail. But, I mean, it was unreal. We hunted it for 12 years.
Wow.
And, we hunted hard. I'd go in there in the summer. It's funny because my hunting partner from Pomeroy, he was in the Nazarene Church and he could always find a couple of young boys, maybe boys with just, a single parent that would want to go with us. And so we'd take them in there and, there's no timber in there. And followed elk trails and we took out some, we dug out some downfall and maybe cut a limb or two off of the brush so we could navigate in the morning before day and get out away from camp. Because every year the circle got wider. And finally we were killing elk clear over on Cook Mountain and coming back at 2 a.m. But anyway, like I say, we all hunted hard. It was like a military camp. The night before, we get all the topo maps and we talk about this and we talk about where one guy was going and where everybody went. And then as soon as one guy got his elk, he'd come back. He'd get his elk out or or one of us would go with him and get it out, and then he'd take care of the horses and cook. And it was kind of the drill, but the habitat was lush. As you said, it's probably one of the most beautiful places I've ever been.
Yeah.
And now, you know, later on we can talk about what's changed. But.
You guys were in there in September, and that was rifle hunting back then?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today. Because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
Did they even have archery seasons during that time?
They did. And we seldom ever saw a bow hunter.
Okay.
And what happened was, after about 8 years, you know, Max Walker was an old-time outfitter. He was a great guy. And then Gordon Stimmel was back in there. And I knew both. Knew Gordon, never knew Max. They were gentlemen. And there weren't many people that ever go in there. There were a few people going in with horses, but not many. And the outfitter camp in there in Paradise Meadow was just... It was just all tromped down, and it was really, it wasn't really very active, and we never saw an outfitter. But then a new guy came in and bought the outfit, and he didn't like the fact that we were going in there and packing out elk. So anyway, we ended up moving over on the other side, on Cook Mountain, and, it, you know, we still hunted the same areas. But, and then... I always remember, right, we have to ride out through the lodge poles and in the dark, and it was real flat up there. And if you didn't know your way, you get lost. And my horse knew his way to where we'd ride out and tie off.
Sure.
And then one day we're riding out there, and I shine my flashlight on the tree, and there's something shining. It's like a thumbtack with fluorescent paint on it. And I'm like, what's that? You know, and then pretty soon I could see another one. Well, bow hunters had showed up and they were putting in those thumbtacks.
Oh yeah.
To get on the ridge. And then it was, we killed an elk almost every year after that with a broad head and shoulder almost okay. every year.
Wow.
That's when they showed up. It was probably, you know, 82, 83, but okay. we never saw them. They would come in off the top onto the south of where we were.
Yeah, over towards out of the Wheatus there, across the Wheatus there, and come up that side of Cook Mountain.
Over the Wheatus Bridge, and then the outfitter he really loaded up. He had 72 hunters in there one year, and he had probably 20, 25 bow hunters. I looked up this, you know, his information on the Forest Service records, and yeah, he had like 20 or more bow hunters. And in those days, those elk were a lot of elk. They didn't know much about bugles. But anyway, yeah.
That's a great way to kind of frame up what kind of country that was and how many elk were living there. My dad, when he got out of the Marines in World War II, then he moved to Weipe and made friends with some of the locals. And they started going up into Kelly Creek there in the late 40s. They would go in there with horses, and what he described too, like the elk trails were just as you described, you know, 2 feet wide, a foot deep, and there were elk everywhere. And they never shot bulls for the most part. It was, they were there for the cows. They would shoot, you know, just the meat. They worried about meat, and they're like, oh, don't shoot one of those old stinky bulls. We want a cow. You know, if somebody shot a bull, then they'd give them a raft of crap about it. But, there was kind of a turning point. An outfitter started guiding up Kelly Creek there, and it sounds like a similar operation, like tons and tons of people in camps and all over the hillsides. And he said it got to be kind of a rat race, and he was there for the quiet and the, you know, getting away and not seeing a bunch of people and then good hunting. And it just got to the point he just gave it up. He's like, well, I'm not going to go back up there anymore. But it's interesting.
We did everything we could to prevent any interference with the outfitter. And we camped at the far end of one outfitter's area. And we basically hunted on the edge of the other outfitter. And frankly, we never saw the outfitters up there except when we're packing meat out. And we stayed out of their way. And
yeah. Well, to this day, if you get on Google Earth and you go to that place that you mentioned, there's a salt lick there that's about the size of my house, and that's still there. And I don't know that there's very many elk hitting that salt lick anymore, but they beat it down so bad back in the 70s and 80s that, you know, nothing will grow in that spot.
Well, the outfitter I've never seen big, you know, big 1 foot diameter or 2 foot chunks of rock salt. And one day he was coming in with his mules and they're all loaded with rock salt. Mm-hmm. And there are big licks in there. But now two of the biggest licks are so overgrown. They're hardly there. And we put some up 2 years ago and left them there from the middle of August till bow season. And on one camera, we had a raghorn bull, a cow, and a yearling. And then those, you know, the licks are still there. There's some deer come in. But, you know, if you've seen those licks, they dig it right down in the ground. And
oh, yeah.
They can't salt anymore. But,
yep.
But there are, you know, there are a lot of other, I met some good friends. My friend would, the guy I hunted with, you asked about hunting partners, but the guy I hunted with, he'd always run into these guys in Tillamook, Oregon, way back up in the head of Cook Creek. Yeah. And I'd never seen it. So it was the first Elk Foundation meeting in Spokane. I had a banquet and I sat down at this table and there was poor guy sitting there. And I introduced myself and couldn't believe it. They were from Tillamook, Oregon. They were the guys that were coming in from the Locksaw.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, you talk about how many of us were hunting. You know, one is great. Two is enough. Three will work. And if you know each other and you care about each other and they're not jealous of each other, four is a good team, but never more than four. And one of the things people always want to know where we're hunting. Well, you know, and then some people get angry if you don't tell them where you're hunting. People followed they're looking at my vehicles and my horse truck and this and that. But we never took new people into the area just because, there's an outfitter in there. We didn't want to bring other people. And if somebody showed up, they showed up. But that was a golden rule for us. We never took anybody outside to our camp. And so we hunted with four guys. And after I quit hunting the Clearwater and moved over into salmon, I hunted with three guys and, two other guys. But you can get too many people in camp.
Right. Right.
And the other little thing that comes into a hunting camp is jealousy.
Yep.
If you're good and you're in good shape and you hunt really hard and you're successful, you'll have somebody that doesn't take care of themselves. They don't take care of their body. They're not in good shape. And they won't push it the extra mile. And pretty soon that person gets jealous. So that's my old man's wisdom on hunting partner.
Yeah.
It's like life. You got to have a good one.
Absolutely. It's almost like when you're looking for a mate, you're looking for a wife. You have to vet that hunting partner so good and make sure that you guys can get along. Because I've seen it, the backcountry can bring out the best in people or it can bring out the worst in people. It's not all, every day's not just easy laying around and enjoying delicious food and sitting around camp. I mean, there's hardships, there's inclement weather, there's difficulties finding game, whatever the difficulty is, those partners have to kind of weather the storm with you and the ones that are really great, they're like worth their weight in gold. And the ones that cause problems, those ones don't get to come back next time.
Well, I talk about the 3-day rule. A lot of people are ready to go home after 3 days.
Oh, yeah.
And dealing with adversity, if you want to be an elk hunter and be successful, you have to be able to deal with adversity. It doesn't make any difference whether it's a horse that's injured or whether you get snow, you get snowed in. It's really cold, the elk move, whatever. And you gotta go the extra mile. And when you find guys in your party that will do that, you've got a perfect team. And it's a team effort. And the other thing that I've always said is, if I can't be just as pleased with the success of my hunting partner as I would be for myself, I'm not a very good hunting partner because, you share the experience and you share the camp. And that I've almost always had 90% of the time hunting partners that were that way. And it's a key to a really enjoyable hunt. One of the questions you had was about mature bulls.
Yeah.
When I first started hunting in there, it was a September opener on a Wednesday, and there were bulls screaming everywhere.
Man.
I mean, and I had the first year we went in, I had a guy that worked at WSU that had some horses. He was a guy from North Dakota. He packed me in and dropped me off. He had four horses. Dropped me off with my gear. And then he left me. I put up my tent, and then he left that same day. That night's a night I'll never forget all my life, because we had inadvertently set our camp right at the crossroads of about three major elk trails.
Oh, no.
I didn't know elk bugle that night.
Yeah.
I'm a rookie. I'm lying there in the tent, and it just gets dark, and I hear this water splash, and I hear this bull just scream. He's like 10 feet from my tent.
Oh, man.
And all night long. And the elk would come down. They'd be splashed in the creek. They'd smell me. And they'd be bugling. I mean, all night long. I didn't sleep all night. Most all the bulls we shot, 90% were mature bulls, mostly all sixes. And, we shot the first really legal bull we could get. Sure. We didn't turn down a 5-point but there weren't very many 5-points. I mean, you know, there were so many mature bulls in there in those days. I've never seen anything like it since.
Wow. Did you ever see any that were just remarkably large, like giant, like, wow, that today, you know, people's always looking, you know, they always throw around big numbers, you know, 400 inches or 350 inches. Would you ever say you saw anything of that kind of caliber back in those days?
There was one in there that would have probably gone 360 or more that some guys from Oregon killed. The biggest bull I killed in there was just short of 340. My buddy, Jerry, he killed one the same night, just short of 340. But that, you know, those are the biggest bulls we saw. Most of them were 300 class 6-points.
Okay.
Maybe, you know, I've been a Boone and Crockett scorer. So when I look at a bull and I say he's a 300, he probably is, but I'm amused at how Boone and Crockett scores are thrown around.
Oh, it's funny. Depending on who you talk to, it's like if I'm talking to one person and they said, yeah, I saw a 300-inch bull, I'll subtract about 20 or 30 inches. And I'm like, okay, so, because a lot of people, as soon as they see a nice 6-point, they're like, oh, there's a 300 bull. Well, a 300 bull is a really nice bull. That's a big, heavy horn bull, good beams, good points. That's a pretty nice bull. They don't grow on every tree. That's for sure.
No, but back, you know, in days we were hunting in there, you can almost always find a nice 6-point the first or second day.
Wow.
Never hunted in 3 days, and we packed meat the fourth day, and when Pag went home the next day, because I had to be at work on Monday. You ask about the condition of the forage and the habitat.
Yeah.
It was perfect. It was ideal. You know, if you go back and read about, you know, the fires that burned in there and two successive different big fires, the conifers were really burned. And there were brush fields, but the brush fields were immature. If you could find a 10-foot in this one great big open area where all these cows were, there were huge meadows and a lot of ferns and would grow in those meadows and stuff. And there was a lot of water, but no conifers at all. And then as you got conifers were, there were a lot of immature conifers, sure. You know, firs, mostly fir, some hemlock in there. And I remember there was one really steep trail or ridge we had to pack meat on, and it was hard to, you know, figure out where you were. And so every once in a while we'd nip the top of a little, like a 3-4 foot Christmas tree, just cut the top off.
Yeah.
About that. And is it because, you know, you could see that and you'd look for that. Now those trees are 50, 20 feet tall, and you can see, you know, they've got triple tops or something. But, yeah, they screw up much. And there are hillsides. We could shoot across I always hunted with a 340 Weatherby, and I knew the ballistics. And you could shoot across from one side to the other. Now you couldn't see an elk on that hillside across there. And then, what's happened? Well, I've gone in there fairly religiously, just to go in there.
Sure.
And look and see, it's such a neat place. I took my kids in there, my daughters, and we'd go in and camp. And was in there 3 years ago, and we probably rode, I don't know, 70 miles through there with the horses. Found one elk track.
Wow.
And you used to be able to ride an ATV from Cayuse Creek, clear across to the Locksaw.
Yep.
And the roads were just, there were elk trails coming down the cut bank, and they just trails foot deep where elk are coming down the cut bank, crossing the road and going across.
Yeah.
So about 7 years ago, I never saw an elk track on that road all the way to Cayuse Meadows from the Locksaw. The elk just aren't there. So what's the deal with the wolves, and what's the remedy? About the time I quit hunting there, the elk numbers were down, but there weren't any wolves there yet. And the black bears, I shot a lot of black bears in the Clearwater. A boatload, because we could shoot two. And we'd go in early, and if I got a brown one, then I'd hunt for a black one. And we shot black bears with, after just minutes after they'd killed an elk calf. But then Mike Schlegel did the study on the elk depredation, or the bear, the depredation by bears. Mm-hmm. Through back, and I'd see Mike up there in the cellway and stop and look at his data, and they had mortality signals on their calves, but at one time the elk mortality in there was like 70-80% on the calves. And the black bears kill a lot of calves.
Right.
And of course then you've got lions. Well, but it's a habitat issue as well. I mean, mm-hmm. People want to blame the wolves. Yeah, the wolves are in there. But you can't just blame the wolf, because it's a combination. Jim Peake is a wildlife biologist that I have always respected, and he'll talk to you about the batholithic soils and how the burn just really burned the soil. The conifers and the brush is coming back, and that's not good elk habitat. So we know about the wolves. I mean, when they're in there, there are a lot of photos on Facebook and stuff, of the wolves killing, slaughtering elk down right on the river. But the combination is the sticker. But now, I Mike Schlegel is a really good friend of mine. He's a wildlife biologist that really has studied that right now. And I've known the fire manager over on the Clearwater. Mm-hmm. He laid out a whole series of burns in the places that really needed to be burned.
Sure.
He laid those out. I saw where he I saw his maps. Guess what? People don't like smoke.
Yeah.
And now they haven't done any of those burns simply because of the image that and the social pressure that people put on the Forest Service because of smoke. And he finally left. But there are all kinds of burn units laid out all over that Clearwater that haven't been burned. And should be burned, but probably never would. So, it's a tragic thing. The other issue I've encountered up there is the motorcycle access.
Okay.
I'm not an anti-ATV motorcycle person, not at all.
Sure.
I had ATVs. I've never had a motorcycle. But the last time I was in there, we camped clear up in the head of Cook Creek and came in from the Locksaw, And the next morning, I wanted to go ride clear back across over and drop into Paradise Meadows and go down where our old camp was. And we were going across Windy Ridge early in the morning. And I, my horses are really gentle. They don't, you know, they motorcycles and stuff don't bother them. And the one horse I had was trailing. He kept jumping around every once in a while. And all of a sudden, I figured out there's a motorcycle right behind him. And oh. the trail had been excavated with those mini excavators. It was 2 feet wide. The brush was cleared 3 feet to each side of it. And there must have been a dozen guys from Missoula. And not that Missoula's a bad place, but there were a dozen guys. You know, they're wearing all their plastic protection, and they had chainsaws. They were riding from Windy Saddle on the Locksaw all the way over into Cook Mountain, down onto the road, all the way down to the Wheatus and up the Wheatus and back up through this cabin and all the way back in one day. Wow. And the Forest Service, I mean, it was a motocross. That was a great motocross trail. And so the worst part was we left an 8-pack of Cold Smoke in the creek.
Oh.
I don't know if you know Cold Smoke. It's our favorite Montana beer. But anyway, when we walked about 50 yards up the creek from where we camped, and we ditched it down in underneath in the water and go back there bow hunting. And there's a trail crew in there. They're cutting trail. I mean, they're cutting brush out of the trail, and the dirty buggers drink our Cold Smoke.
Oh, no.
Anyway, but now, it's, you know, if you've got a bike and you like to ride the backcountry trails, it's the epitome. I mean, it's the best there is.
Yeah.
And then the next day, we were out on Cook Mountain, some guys from Potlatch, Idaho. I could hear them coming, and my horse isn't, you know, he's not spooked. But this guy came ripping around the corner and laid his bike down right in the trail. So he didn't run into me. And the guy said to me, he says, "Wow," he says, "you're the first guys I've ever seen up here on horses since pre-Wolf." And he anyway, you know, the Clearwater is an absolutely special place. And, you know, I've got a few friends that are still getting some really nice bulls out of there.
Yeah.
You know, I know kind of where they are, and you know, they don't say much. They just go in there and hunt.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there, because they're great and they're super friendly, and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land.
Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
It's a daunting place if you've never been there or never hunted country like that. I know, yeah, there's some people who live there close by or have spent a lot of years up in that country hunting that they'll find success. A lot of folks who hunt from out of state will come up and never been there, and they might spend 10 days without even seeing an elk. Just because it seems like it's kind of the population of elk is a little bit pockety. Like you may go miles and miles without seeing anything, and then one little pocket, the elk feel really safe, or maybe the wolves don't bother them there, or people don't bother them there. Whatever reason, they'll have a little spot they like to be, and you'll find some elk. And it's like winning the lottery, finding one of those spots.
Yeah. And as far as wolves, there used to be a lot of wolves in there. You could hear wolves howling every day, bow hunting. And now you don't hear them very often, or seldom.
I think they follow the food, you know, and as the elk numbers decline, then they keep moving to try to find food. They probably move closer to town, for sure.
I'll chase one side rabbit, and then we'll talk about my book if you'd like. But I used to run into some guys from Pennsylvania, clear out. On the backside over there, and they had a gun that looked like it was a 6.5 Weatherby, or 6.5 Weatherby WWH. Now it's in the old days it was a Weatherby Wright Hoyer long range rifle, and they had a bench rest set up in front of their tent, and they had basically wall tent and a bench rest, spotting soap, and they were shooting elk 800 or 900 yards across the canyon.
Yeah.
And I asked him how many they'd lost. And he said, the problem is we get over there and the brush is thick. We can't find some of them. Anyway, I mentioned it. And I was talking to Mike Schlegel about it. Now there's a limit on the weight of the gun you can use, or the rifle you can use. But so with my book, I'll just be fairly short. It's called The Hunting Horseman. It's available at Western Hunter. On the website, on the Western Hunter website, you can just Google it and find it.
Yeah. What's the title of your book?
It's called The Hunting Horseman.
Okay.
And so after I left Moon and Kroc and stuff, Ryan Hatfield is a guy I'd hired from Council Idaho as assistant director of Big Game. And he left and he went to work for Eastman's and such, and he ended up with Western Hunter. And they wanted to start a new elk hunter magazine. So he called me and asked me if I would be willing to write an article every month or whatever. I said, well, yeah, but he said, why don't you write about horses? I said, well, Ryan, I said, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there about saddles and how to pack horses, and Smoke Elser's got books out, and you know, Joe Back wrote the original one and all that stuff. So really about horse packing, the techniques, that's pretty well covered. But I said, you know, if you want me to write something, I'll write about using stock in the backcountry for hunting, period.
Yeah.
And so I started writing some articles 12 years or 11 years ago. So I wrote all, I was writing these articles and they were published, and then kind of in in the middle of that, I wrote an article that was entitled Pack Like a Hunter. Okay. Well, if you're going to go into your hunting camp every year, there's certain things you take every year. There's certain things you can weigh up ahead of time. You don't need to be manning everything up and having all these fancy knots, and there's a lot of ways to do it. Anyway, that was a really interesting article. But anyway, so my health changed dramatically 1 year ago, February, Valentine's Day, and we didn't know how much time I had. And so Chris Denning, the publisher of Western Hunter, called me. He said, George, he says, what do you think about putting all your articles in a book? I said, yeah, that'd be kind of cool. And so we spent some time February and March, and they compiled all of the articles I'd written for the Western. Actually, it started out Elk Hunter, then it went to Western Hunter. So they put it all together, and it turned out really nice, really well. It's full color, the whole thing. It has some tributes friends have written that hunted with me, but you won't find another book like it. It's got stuff in there, things in there about access, and it's got things in there about conservation issues and stuff. But most of it's about hunting and everything from how you put up a wall tent with poles to where you site your camp. But it's 300 pages. It's good reading. It turned out really
well. I'm wondering, are those guys going to have those available at the Western Hunter Expo or Western Hunting Expo in Salt Lake City next week?
Well, Chris just got back from SCI, and I'll suggest that he have some available. Yeah, there was limited production of like 1,000, but I'm going to talk with him about it. Yeah,
that's good. I'll have to go by their booth, and I always like to try to track those guys, Chris and Nate, and those guys from Western Hunter down anyway, and razz them a little bit, and I hope they got the book. I've been wanting to pick it up, so maybe I'll be able to pick one up there. Well, if not, I'll just order it on the website.
Yeah, it's a book you'll keep or you'll pass on to your relatives or your children that like to hunt, because it's a basic Boy Scout manual, but not really.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, so any last comments on the Clearwater country? And, there's been some wildfires in the last decade there, but maybe haven't been strategic to where it would still help the elk population rebound. What needs to happen to get that elk population to rebound in the Clearwater region? What do you think it's going to look like in 5-10 years from now? Because I know there's a lot of that timber that's maturing, and if you spend any time up there, you'll see a lot of deadfall from beetle kill, and then there's some of the wildfire as well. But what do you think the future holds for the Clearwater?
It really depends on the Forest Service. It really depends on the Forest Service, because there are a lot of things they could do up there that are, good forest practices. But in order to create elk habitat, you have to have open areas. You have to have, feeding areas and bedding areas and tree canopies. But there has to be grass that they eat. And when it is all brush, and so you've got to burn that brush. The brush has to be burned. And they know how to do it. But the social pressure and the current leadership in the Forest Service have not seen fit to do it. But they have a plan, and it's all been mapped out. And it's a habitat issue, number one. Fish and Game's dealing with the wolves. They've gone in there with a trapper and taking some out with the helicopter outfit. But it's a big time thing is the habitat. And somehow we've got to figure that out. But we know what to do. The sad thing is we know what to do. Mike Schlegel and I have talked about this forever. And he's made charts about how important that elk resource was to the economy of Idaho and all that. He's charted the, you know, the decline in the herds. And, but any biologist that knows that country will just tell you it's a habitat issue, and we've got to burn some of that stuff. You know,
you can't just fix one thing and expect everything to be to work. You got to multi things you got to fix, whether predation, habitat, access, all of it. Fix everything, and then, you know, those animals are going to flourish again.
Yeah, the two bear limit, or, you know, the opportunity for hunters to take two bears and a reduced tag, that's really important for fish and game. It's very important because there are a lot of bears in the Clearwater. Yep. And, you know, in the old days, this guy Ralph Flowers used to be a bear hunter for Weyerhaeuser on the west coast of Washington. And, you know, bears will strip bark off of a young, you know, 2 foot diameter tree, and they strip the bark off to get to the cambium. And that's why, you know, Flowers was hired to kill bears in the Weyerhaeuser forest, because they're stripping cambium or stripping the bark. You can go up there, and you've never been talking about, and the trees are all stripped. I mean, they're stripped everywhere. And, yeah. You know, tell it, you can see it. And yep. If you want to go hunting, it's a good spot. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and then, I don't know, conservation organizations, you know, I don't know what the Elk Foundation could do to fund some stuff in there, but they've got to work hand in hand with the Forest Service. If the Forest Service doesn't give the go-ahead, you know, it won't happen.
Do you think we could get enough sportsmen to put pressure on the fish, or not the fishing game, but the Forest Service to maybe take a look at some of those kind of things? You know, I feel like it seems like the people that don't want you to burn, they have a bigger voice than the people, the other side, you know. I feel like just getting organized and getting enough people involved would maybe help turn the tide a little bit. What do you think?
Well, hunters just don't speak up.
Right.
I mean, we just don't speak up. We don't write letters. We just don't speak up. And you can look at any of these issues, like with the wolves right now in Montana. You've got thousands of letters being sent to Fish and Game to reduce the wolf harvest. Well, hunters will go to public meetings. We complain, but we're not very aggressive. And I guess, you know, the young hunters that are coming on, if there's anything that they can take away from this podcast, is get involved. Get involved with your local sports organization and get involved. And, you know, the Elk Foundation is a great organization. You know, get involved with that. But don't just go to a banquet, you know. Talk to these people, and you get a hold of their lands people, and like in the Clearwater, you know, I was one of the guys that put together the Lewiston banquet years ago. It was the fifth banquet they ever had, and or fifth place, and we have 1,000 people in Lewiston. But you get those people rallied up about the Clearwater, you know, and you've got to. It's about numbers, and you don't go there and holler at a public meeting. You go to the people that can make it happen. But, you know, this whole future of that, you know, is in the hands of our young people, especially our young hunter conservationists. You know, it's one thing to go hunting all the time, but it's another thing to spend some time helping raise money for, you know, wildlife and conservation issues too. You can do both. I did.
Yeah.
You know? You got to have a side hustle for conservation along with your job.
There you go. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, and, you know, people don't, they think, oh, I don't have time to, you know, write letters or reach out or call your representatives or your legislators in your state or whatever. But it doesn't take any time. I mean, you can pick up the phone and start calling and spend 30 minutes on one particular day, or you could tip, you know, you could type out a professional sounding email within an hour or maybe two. And there's so much, you know, if maybe you feel like you're not a great letter writer. Today there's all this AI, you know, for all of us young people, there's all this AI technology that will, you know, that will like ChatGPT, that will help you write the best sounding letter anyone could write. Yeah. And then, you know, send those letters to these organizations and let them know what you're thinking, because if the opposition is just crushing us with their letters, man, the folks on our side of the table got to stand up and do some stuff too. So, I appreciate you bringing that up.
Well, that's the future. Really is. Our young hunters are very enthusiastic about going farther into the backcountry and hunting elk way back off the grid, and they've got the latest, lightweight gear and camo and sleeping in hammocks and sleeping in hot tents and all that. The thing that makes me smile is I see them. They're clear back 10 miles off the grid over an 8,000 foot summit, and they don't have a clue how they're going to get their elk out of there. That's a whole other story.
That's a huge undertaking.
But anyway, Derek, this has been really a nice visit with you. And
yeah,
call me back. And if you want to share my Facebook stuff, maybe people can get a hold of me. I have people call me all the time about, hunting and different things and
sure.
Rifles or whatever. And I always help. I'm always willing to help.
So people can look you up on Facebook, and mm-hmm. It's George Bettis. How do you say your last name?
Bettis. Bettis.
Okay.
Bettis is close enough.
Okay. Bettis is even better. And do you have Instagram?
I do. Yeah. I think it's just G Bettis on Instagram.
Okay. Right. Well, that's great, man. I've really enjoyed this conversation. And as you described that country back in the old days, my head was just spinning thinking about, those bulls bugling all night long and, the meadows full of elk. And if you've seen that country, it makes your head spin. And to see what it is today, it's a very stark contrast. Like, you could probably give people a map and say, oh yeah, go hunt an elk up there, because you're not really giving anything away at this point. There's just not much for elk up there.
But I still like to go back and visit those old spots and go over to where old Gordon Stimmel used to camp in different places and, where I used to camp, and then go ride a loop down towards the Wheatus and that. It's just, there's special places on this earth where you've been, me usually hunting. And yep. There's a special feeling you get there. There's the smell. We used to have grass 2 feet tall at our camp.
Right.
And after you just turn the horses out with the hobbles, and they're knee-deep grass. They hardly walk 100 yards from the tent. Now, almost any place you go is so dry on these ridge tops, and the cows have eaten out the riparian areas. You got to pack your own feed. And wow. That was so neat about that camp. It was, and pressure, hunting pressure. There were a few guys that would hike in, but most guys would use the road system. And I mean, I never saw anybody else other than a few guys I knew that had horses in there in all those years, 12 years.
Wow. Well, it's an amazing place for sure.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you involving me, and I can do anything else for you or any of your listeners.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming on here. It's been a pleasure for sure.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
Outdoor Adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.